Welcome to the Musings on Sports podcast for August 2nd, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin here along with my co-host Bob Bupka. And Bob, we obviously are going to talk about the legacy of Bill Russell, who passed away on Sunday. But as we record this, news has just come down that the Washington Nationals have executed a major trade involving Juan Soto. Been really everything that's been discussed in baseball for about the past 2 weeks with Soto, the talented three-time All-Star right fielder, and another terrific player for the Nationals, Josh Bell, their first baseman, going to the San Diego Padres for a haul of players, including Eric Hosmer and C.J. Abrams and a terrific pitcher in Mackenzie Gore. So a lot of players coming the Nationals' way. But, Bob, I have to tell you, 3 years removed from me watching my team win the World Series, the Nationals, and then really seeing them having slumped to the bottom of the baseball standings and now letting go of a player unprecedented, really, at 23 years of age, who had turned down a contract worth $440 million. It's a sad day as a Nationals fan, but I got to tell you what, if I was a San Diego Padres fan, I would be absolutely elated with having Soto now to join Fernando Tatis Jr. and Manny Machado. It makes them a legitimate contender to win the World Series in the National League West, particularly loaded, as always, with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So, big day in baseball, and I know that you follow baseball a little bit, but the Juan Soto news certainly has been in the news for quite some time.
Well, you're right about that, Kelly. It was much anticipated, but the closer it got to the deadline, we thought maybe the Nationals weren't going to pull the trigger, but they did, and now San Diego has let it be known that they're going to be going after a World Series title with everything they got. And I think with the addition of Soto and the other changes that were made, you got to like the Padres come this fall classic.
Yeah, you do. They also traded yesterday for Josh Hader, who had a terrific reliever closer for the Milwaukee Brewers. So the Padres are all in. And good for them. There's a lot of talent out there, and they need that because the Dodgers are so talented. It just seemed to be able to replenish year after year, even when they lose good players. So lots and lots of talented major leaguers now on the West Coast, particularly between the Dodgers and the Padres. And hey, Bob, speaking of the West Coast, there was a guy who played basketball for the University of San Francisco back in the 50s by the name of Bill Russell, who won two NCAA titles there and then went on to be drafted by the Boston Celtics, won 11 NBA titles. And as we know, the great Bill Russell passed away on Sunday. Talk about leaving behind an incredible legacy, both on the court and off.
Yeah, and I can't help but, compare two true legends that both played for Boston their entire career. I mean, Bill Russell never played for another NBA team, and Carl Yastrzemski never played for another major league team. I mean, that's unheard of in light of the Soto trade and all the trades that have taken place. And the major difference, obviously, between Bill Russell and Carl Yastrzemski, Carl's contribution was strictly on the field. He did not get involved in anything off the field, whereas Bill Russell took it on his shoulders to try and make this world a better place to live, and what a job he did. As outstanding as he was on the basketball court, I think he was even a better an American, and it's just a sad day in the world of sports that we lose Bill Russell at the age of 88.
Yeah, and he stood for so many principles and really stood for them throughout his playing career and certainly long after. Bob, if you look at Bill Russell, just in terms of his defensive skills, as I noted in my Monday Musings on my Facebook page, he averaged more than 22 rebounds a game for his career. A dozen straight seasons of 1,000 or more rebounds. He averaged 8 blocked shots per game in his career. And Rick Barry, who another Hall of Famer who we're going to hear from later in this episode of Musings on Sports, as you'll hear from Rick, Russell was on his all-time NBA team, but he said Russell wouldn't even need to score any points. He said he could just play defense, rebound, and block shots and be an incredible force that way. Russell was unique in a sense, 12-time NBA All-Star, but he never averaged more than 20 points a game. He was a very, very, very good offensive player. But as a defender, and Leslie Visser, a pioneer in her own right, who was a prior guest on Musings on Sports, she reached out to me today, and being a native Bostonian, Leslie wrote, said, it doesn't matter what his stats were. Russell changed the game to a vertical game. Until Russell came along, centers were big space eaters, and defense was a curiosity. Bill made it about defense and rebounding and agility and anticipation. And Bob, the greatest champion in team sports with 11 titles in his career, I'm not sure you could ever put anybody up there close to Bill Russell.
No, I agree wholeheartedly, yeah. Bill was in a class of his own, and he did things that really are valuable to basketball teams that when you initially look at it, what's he score? You know, what kind of shooter is he? But Bill Russell had all the other things that make a team win, rebounds and defense. Those are the unglamorous positions on the basketball court, but Bill Russell did it with style. He did it with flair, and he certainly was a major, major, major contributor to the NBA certainly a leading pioneer to making the NBA what it is today.
Yeah, and in 2009, the NBA renamed the NBA Finals MVP Award in Bill Russell's honor and well-deserved, to say the least. Bill also, as we're going to make a little bit of a segue here, Bill captained the United States gold medal Olympic winning team in 1956. And in speaking about captains, as we transfer a little bit over to the golf business of golf, Luke Donald gets the nod yesterday to replace Henrik Stenson as the captain for Europe for the 2023 Ryder Cup team. Stenson obviously was relieved of his duties when he accepted monies and the opportunity to play for the LIV Golf Invitational Series. Stenson then, Henrik went on and won his first event on Sunday. Bob, do you have any initial take on Luke Donald and what he brings to the captaincy for Europe?
Well, I've known Luke a long time. Certainly a wonderful ambassador to the game, but under the circumstances, it's almost like the groom decided to bail at the last minute, and the best man stood up and said, "Well, I'll marry you." You know, Luke will do well with the European Ryder Cup team, but you know he's got added pressure now because the first time something doesn't go exactly right, he may hear, you know, behind the scenes, "Well, Stenson wouldn't have done that," and you know, he wasn't the first choice. But I wish Luke the very best, an outstanding human being. And I think wholeheartedly that the European players will rally behind Luke Donald and, you know, do everything in their power to win that Ryder Cup when it's contested in Rome.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think he's a very popular pick. It is in kind of a funny position. It ultimately will come down, of course, to how players perform when it gets to outside of Italy in September of 2023. Let's talk for a second about the LIV Golf Tour or the LIV Golf Invitational. Now, they're going to go to 14 events next year, Bob. A lot of talk, and I think it's not just smoke but fire that once the FedEx Cup playoffs come to an end at the end of this month, end of August, you will see more named players who will leave the PGA Tour and head over to LIV. So that that chasm, if you can, between or that fragility right now, at least in golf, it looks like it's going to continue for some time.
Well, you're right on the money there, Kelly. I can't see it getting better before it gets worse. Where is it going to end? I'm not smart enough to be able to figure that out. I know there's been many a sleepless night for Jay Monahan, the commissioner of the PGA Tour. He wants to do the right thing. It's just a fine line. And I think that the real criteria is going to be if members of LIV somehow, some way, eligible to play in the majors, that's going to be a real blow to the PGA Tour. Now, if they're excluded from playing in the majors, it's going to make going to LIV less attractive, and it may just be the traction that the PGA Tour needs to survive this out-and-out civil war, and that's basically what it is now. The latest rumors I heard just over the last couple of hours that all kinds of dollars were being thrown towards Tiger Woods. I feel very confident. This rumor has popped up before. I don't think Tiger in any way, shape, or form would ever consider going to LIV. I mean, because all they have to offer him is money. And when you have Tiger Woods money, you're not going to be tempted by too much other money. I mean, it's almost like a golfer that has the ability to shoot his 34. Is he going to go crazy to be able to shoot 33? Or is he just going to bask in the glory of shooting that 34 and have it mentioned on Facebook and on Musings on Sport? I mean, 34 has suddenly become a very magical number in the world of golf.
Well, there's no question that it has. And for someone, namely me, who's probably more accustomed to shooting 44 on a given nine, had a lot of fun last week in a big intra-club match. And my buddy, A.J. Walker, on the 10th tee, as I noted in my Monday blog, said to me, "I think you've got a little 34 in you on this nine, partner. And doggone if I didn't go out and make a few birdies and shoot that." So, yeah, the word seems to be getting out, Bob, about that magical 34, but I would like to think that that the guys on the PGA Tour and LIV, 34 would be a good score. They'd like to go a lot lower, but for me, 34 is about as good as it gets.
Well, it's going to be tough handling all those member guests, the invitations that are probably going to be coming in from probably all over the country. I mean, somebody with a handicap like that, that can shoot at 34, boy, I know I'd love you playing in my member guests.
Well, that's right. If my 4 or 5 handicapper index can match up with that inflated number that you have, we can win a whole lot of member guests. That's what I'm talking about. Whole lot of golf shop credit and little trophies. Hey, before we close and move on to Rick Barry, the NFL season in a way gets started this week. We've got the Pro Football Hall of Fame game in Canton, Ohio, between the Las Vegas Raiders and the Jacksonville Jaguars. We have some terrific players, Tony Boselli, Cliff Branch, being inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame on Saturday, along with Dick Vermeil, the legendary coach. Football, Bob, boy, they're hitting pads or hitting hard at camps throughout the NFL. It's football sort of this coming Thursday, but about a month from now on a Thursday, it gets going for real.
I think the NFL staring right down the barrel of quite a black eye with Deshaun Watson. I mean, the suspension that I've heard is 6-game suspension. I mean, 24 females reported, at best misbehavior by Deshaun Watson. He's got a contract that's worth hundreds of millions of dollars, and he gets a 6-game suspension. Good golly, Miss Molly Kindergartner's for not paying attention to the teacher get stronger penalties than Deshaun Watson has been assessed at this juncture. We'll wait and see if the NFL decides to go along with that or maybe to step in and make it a little more believable. I mean, you hear about the proverbial slap on the wrist. Well, I refer to this as maybe a slap on the pinky.
Yeah, I'm with you on this. And the NFL does have the right to appeal. And if the NFL does appeal, then it goes to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. He's the one that the appeal jumps up to make the decision on whether the current six-game suspension should and will be enlarged. I would think that it probably would go that route. The whole story was extremely complicated, yucky, disgusting in many ways, and it just, I'm with you. It just, the six games just didn't seem to add up, but everything that I've heard, the Cleveland Browns, Deshaun Watson's new team, they anticipated about a six-game suspension, and the combined records of their first six opponents from last year, their combined records from 2021 were 44 wins and 57 losses and one tie. So Jacoby Brissett, who's likely to step in and play a lot of quarterback for the Browns, will be going into a lot of games those first six, if it's only six, that where the Browns have a chance to win. I can tell you a guy who won a lot and scored a lot was the great Rick Barry. You're going to hear his thoughts on Bill Russell. You're going to hear his thoughts on a lot of things. He was a dynamic, exciting guest. He will be joining us shortly for a terrific interview, and you'll hear that right after these words from our friends at Bridgestone Golf.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. What a treat it is to be joined by one of the most prolific scorers and all-around great players in basketball history. He is the only player to lead the NCAA, the American Basketball Association, and the National Basketball Association in points per game in a season. He was revered for his underhanded style of free throw shooting and renowned as a member of the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame Class of 1987. Rick Barry, thanks very much for joining us on Musings on Sports.
Happy to be with you.
Hey, Rick, you know, there's so many ways we could start this interview, but let's begin with how you came to wear number 24 throughout your extraordinary career. I heard some talk, maybe it had something to do with Willie Mays.
Well, actually, I was a better baseball player when I, growing up, I was actually a better baseball player in high school than I was a basketball player. And my father taught me how to catch fly balls when I was a young kid using the basket catch that Willie Mays made famous. And it turned out that he was a rookie that year with the Giants, and being raised in New Jersey, obviously, I was a Giants fan when they were back there. And so that became my guy. I made a pretty damn good choice, I guess. And so the amazing thing is about it, this is my boyhood hero. And as I grew and got into being an adult and became a professional athlete myself, not in baseball but in basketball, I wind up going out to San Francisco where the Giants moved to, and wind up later in life becoming a personal friend of my boyhood hero. So that's a pretty amazing story.
Yeah, it really is. And back in the early 60s, Rick, there were great men's basketball teams, UCLA, Ohio State, Cincinnati, North Carolina, Kansas. So how and why did a New Jersey kid end up going to play college basketball at the University of Miami?
Well, because I wanted to get out of New Jersey. I didn't want to spend any winters where I went to college where I have to put on gloves and overcoats and scarves. And, you know, so I had a chance to go someplace where they were not a big powerhouse. They had a coach who was a former pro player. They played a pro style of basketball, which suited my game because I was fast and quick both for my size. And I was going to go play where I can go to school in shorts and a t-shirt.
Yeah, it beat the heck out of New Jersey, didn't it?
Yeah, sure as heck does. I mean, it beats the heck out of a lot of places.
You got that right.
Hey, delighted to be joined by 8-time NBA All-Star Rick Barry here on Musings on Sports. Hey, Rick, you were drafted by the San Francisco Warriors, as they were then, second pick overall in the 65 NBA draft, went on to be named Rookie of the Year. Bob and I want to kind of pop a number of questions your way about your career, but I want to just ask a couple of general questions before we get into more specifics. Can you give our listeners, particularly maybe younger listeners, a sense of the difference of the NBA style of play from your era versus the very free-flowing, three-point dominated shot of today? It almost seems to me as two different games in many respects.
Well, it's become a predominant three-point game nowadays. I mean, if you don't shoot three-point shots at a pretty high efficiency rate, you're going to have a very difficult chance of winning. And that's just, you know, goes with the change. I mean, you had guys like Steph Curry came along and all the young kids are admiring him and trying to emulate him. And so we've got much better three-point shooters coming into the game. In fact, I'm astonished sometimes when I see some of these NBA teams that have guys who are wing players who can't shoot over 30% from three-point range. Why in the world they are on your team? I mean, it's worthless to have a guy playing on your team that can't shoot the ball from three-point range. I mean, that's just the reality of the game today. Now, I still do think that too many teams don't play basketball the way it's meant to be played, like the Warriors have played it for so many years. That's one of the reasons they've been the dominant team over the last 8 years or so. And if they hadn't lost and had injuries and stuff, they could have won a couple more championships during that 8-year stretch. Because they pass, they move, they cut, they play unselfishly. They play the game the way the game was designed to be played. And the biggest difference is that a lot of the players playing the game today have not been schooled in the fundamental principles of what basketball is all about. And therefore, they will never become as good as they should become because they don't know how to utilize the most amazing God-given talents that they have. And with the training and the sophistication of the training that exists in all sports today, it's amazing. People say to me, Rick, you guys couldn't play with these guys today. And I say, are you crazy? You must be on drugs. I said, if I played today, do you know how much better I would be? We had nothing. We had no strength coach, no agility coach, no dietitian. We had a travel commercial. We get to bed at 2 a.m, get up at 5 or 6:30 and catch a commercial flight to play the next night. It is such a different game in that respect. I would be faster, stronger, quicker, more endurance. It would be crazy how much better I would be and all of my contemporaries who played during the 60s and 70s. We didn't have what the players have today. And so that's the biggest difference in the game. And I'm going to say something that you brought up just before you started asking the other questions.
Yeah.
It's so interesting how people always brought up and they bring up like it's such a great thing that you brought up. You're a rookie of the year in the rookie year. Yeah, I was rookie. No, I was first team all pro in my rookie year. That is a lot different than being first team rookie. And people never seem to bring that up. It's rare that ever happens in professional basketball. And it only happened because I made the choice to go to Miami. And I got to play for Bruce Hale, who was a former pro player. And I basically went to school because you couldn't come out of school early then. I had 4 years, only 3 of varsity, because you couldn't even play as a freshman under varsity. 4 years of playing basically like in the minor leagues, getting prepared to play in the pros. And that's why when I went to the pros, it wasn't a huge adjustment for me because I was playing NBA-style basketball. In fact, it was easier for me than in college. In college, the entire defense and every game that I played in my senior year was geared to stop me. I played boxing, triangle and two, boxing one. They were all geared to me. When I went to the pros, I had one guy guarding me. I said, this is unbelievable. I only got one guy to worry about. Well, of course, when I beat him going to the basket, I had to worry about guys like Chamberlain and Russell and guys that were amazing centers that they don't have that many of them these days. But it was easier for me, actually, to play in the NBA, probably than most players, because of what I was experiencing, what I learned from my college coach, Bruce Hale.
That's fascinating to hear what you're saying. And Bob and I both, having been in the golf industry a long time, hey, Rick, we see the same thing of young golfers coming along who are much better athletes today than they were back in your time. Young golfers who are coming along who are so much better prepared to step in and compete right away on the PGA Tour as opposed to those perhaps back in the 60s and 70s. It's just different altogether in terms of that approach today. I do want to ask you, you talked about having to beat that one guy or play against that one guy. Who's the best player you ever played against and why?
I played against so many great players, can't pick just one. I mean, I played against some of the greatest players in the history of the game. People were in the top 50. I played against so many of them. I mean, I got to play against my boyhood basketball idol, Elgin Baylor. I mean, I had to pinch myself. I'm on the court guarding my boyhood basketball idol that I try to emulate. And, I mean, it was kind of crazy. And I played against Chamberlain. I played against Russell. I played against Sam Jones. I played against so many great players. I played against, you know, obviously, you know, Walt Frazier, Earl Monroe, Willis Reed. I mean, I could just go on and on and on. I mean, Jerry West. I mean, just, it was crazy, the guys that I got to play against.
It's kind of an unfair question to ask you. How would you put, if you had, say, a Mount Rushmore of a starting five all-time NBA greats, who would you put there? Who are the greatest five you've ever, that you played against or seen?
Well, first of all, it's crazy to compare people. You should, I don't understand why they even do this, and this thing with the GOAT and everything. It's ridiculous. You can't pick the greatest of all time in a sport that's a team sport. You have to go by positions. And when people do that, it drives me nuts. I mean, you can't compare Willie Mays to Sandy Koufax.
Right.
Or Willie Mays to, a catcher to Yogi Berra or something. I mean, come on. Every position requires different skills to play. So if you're going to compare in sports, compare them by positions. And you should always compare them by decades. You can pick and play. You know, people say, oh, Shaq, Kareem. No. I mean, during his time, Shaq was the most dominant center during his time. Okay? There was nobody. There's been nobody like Wilt Chamberlain. I mean, nobody will ever be like Wilt Chamberlain to dominate the way that he did. So you just have to do it that way. For me, if I was going to play, I'll tell you a team that I would play on, that I'm going to play small forward. I'm taking Wilt Chamberlain as my center. I'm taking Bill Russell and putting in that power forward because I don't need him to score a point. Right. Let him take defense, rebound. And then I'm taking Michael Jordan as my two. And the hardest choice for me would be, you know, I'd probably be Magic Johnson because of his versatility. However, if we were going to play it with the three-point shot, which we didn't have back when I played, and that had to be a part of it, I'd be hard-pressed not to want Steph Curry on my team.
Is he the best pure shooter in the history of the game?
He's the greatest long-distance shooter. There's been other great shooters. West was a great shooter. There's a lot of great shooters from mid-range. But, I mean, this guy, it's insane what he's did. I mean, they keep all these statistics now. One season, he shot 48% from 28 feet. People play the game in their whole career. From 10 feet, 8 feet, they couldn't shoot 48%.
Hey, Rick, let me ask, if Wilt Chamberlain was 6 inches shorter, would he still have been a great player?
Of course. 6 inches wouldn't have made that much difference. I mean, hell, he could jump so high and do everything. It wasn't so much of the height, it's just his ability. I mean, he was a great athlete. People don't understand what an athlete. He ran over under 50 seconds in the 440. He high jumped over 7 feet. He was an amazing athlete. I mean, just an amazing athlete. You know, he became an incredible beach volleyball player, and he was so strong and so powerful. I mean, come on, 50 points a game. I don't think people have any understanding of just how insane that is. I mean, I averaged 36 or something, almost 37 points a game. And I'm saying, okay, I got to play 80-something games, and I got to figure out a way to score 13 or 14 more points every game in all of those in 80-something games. There's guys, and most guys in their career never even averaged that 13 points for their career in any one season. And his rebounding totals were obscene. He had seasons where he averaged over 25 rebounds a game for his career. He averaged 22 points rebounds a game. And I hear people talking about, oh, Dennis Rodman this and this guy. But you got to be out of your mind to compare anybody to Wilt Chamberlain.
Hey, Rick, boy, I could listen to you for hours. One thing that's I'd love to know, what motivated you to jump to the ABA?
Because basketball had always been fun for me. Wasn't never a job. I loved the game. I was taught how to play the game the right way, and I loved the game. And I came, I was first team All-Pro again in my second year. I was All-Star MVP. I led the league in scoring. I was one of the best players in the game. We came within two pick-and-roll plays involving my teammate Nate Thurman and me and Wilt Chamberlain that had they gone our way instead of Philly's way, we might have been champions in 1967.
Right.
And I didn't have a lot of fun. Taking nothing away from it. As a person, I really, really liked Bill Sharman. As a coach, he wasn't fun to play for because he made it not fun. He made it like a job. We got hardly any days off. He's the one that started this morning shoot-around garbage, which I think is the biggest waste of energy in the world. I mean, well, back in those days, we only put jeans on and shorts. And I know what it was, to get you out of bed, right? So you didn't leave your game in your bed because you just laid around all day. But, you know, you could accomplish that by just get us out of bed, go to a meeting room in the hotel. Let's go over the strategies you're going to have that night. And if you wanted to have a practice, let the guys who don't play 40 minutes a game or something go practice. I don't need a practice. I wish that I would have been a veteran, because I would have done what Will Chamberlain did when he was at the end of his career. He got to play for Bill Sharman when he went to the Lakers and they established the 33 in the game consecutive wins and won a championship there. Will Chamberlain said to him, this is the greatest ever. He said, here's the deal, Bill. I'm going to show up at the arena one time today. Do you want me at 10 in the morning or at 7 at night?
That's awesome.
That's too good. Too
good. Chamber, and he could say that, right?
Of course that he could say that. I mean, I was just a second-year player, so I'd have the nerve to say that. I mean, but I was thinking it, though.
Yeah. Hey, I've got to ask you, in the 67 finals, obviously you didn't win. The Sixers won that in six. You averaged almost 41 points a game in that series. It's a NBA record, stood for about three decades. Rick, can you bring back some memories, some moments that stood out in that series? And is it correct? Did you literally have cortisone shots in your knee every one of the game days in that six-game series?
Well, basically, I mean, the only reason the record was broken is Michael Jordan broke it, but Michael Jordan played in an overtime game and scored 8 points. If it wasn't for that, I'd still have the record. And I didn't play in an overtime game. But it wasn't my knee. It wasn't my knee. It was my ankle. I couldn't have played. In fact, they probably wouldn't have let me play nowadays, because all the money that these guys spend, they wouldn't have wanted to gamble on, you know, somebody who's making $40, $50 million a year. Right. I got shot before the game at halftime to play. That's how bad my ankle was. And I still average. I said, I'd love to have seen what I could have done if I was healthy.
Well, we're finishing up our time right now with the great Rick Barry. And I'm sorry it's coming to an end, because very few interviews have I enjoyed as much as this. When you retired, you were the most accurate free throw shooter in NBA history, making 90% of your attempts. And I've been dying to ask this question. What was the motivation? What was the catalyst behind going underhand foul shooting for Rick Barry?
Well, it's because my father was a semi-pro player and coach, and he shot underhanded free throws. Back in those days, they shot two hands overhand, two hands underhand. Thank God he was relentless about it, because I didn't want to do it. You know, I said, Dad, that's the way girls are shooting. I can't do that. They'll make fun of me. And I remember like it was yesterday. He said, son, they can't make fun of you if you're making them. And so to my credit, I gave it a sincere effort. The more I practiced it and worked on it that summer, I said, wow, this is really pretty good. So I made the change in high school, and it was either my junior or senior year. I don't remember which one, but I do know that I remember the first time I did it in a game on the road, and the guy yelled out from the stands when I was shooting. He said, hey, Barry, you big sissy shooting like that. And I heard so clearly the guy next to him say, what are you making fun of him for? He doesn't miss. And so I was cool from that point on. And then I just wish I had been smart enough make the refinement that I made late in my career. I still think I was the best free throw shooter ever in the history of NBA basketball or pro basketball, but they have beat me with their percentages. But at the end of my career, when I made the refinement, my last 6 years, I averaged over 92%, which is higher than anybody. My last 2 years, I averaged over 94%. And it is much more difficult to shoot a high percentage if you're taking only two or three free throws a game, because if I miss one, I have to go weeks without missing anything to get it up over and high into the 90s. And early in my career, I was shooting over 10 a game. So if I missed one, I could still shoot over 90%, but the technique was so more consistent because I took the wrist out of the shot, and that's why I got to be so proficient at it. In fact, Andre Drummond from the Pistons, when he was with them number of seasons ago,
yeah,
he missed 23, I think it was 22 or 23 free throws in one game. One game. My last two full seasons in the NBA, I missed a total of 19. 10 in one season, 9 in another.
Wow.
And I brag about that, because it's the only part of the game of basketball that you can be selfish and help your team. Yeah.
Well, of course you should brag about it. And I know you've been asked this many times, but why didn't anybody else model what you've done? Why are there no other NBA players that I can think of who shot underhanded? I don't understand that.
Yeah, there were a few that did it. When I came in, Guy Rogers and Dave Gamby did it. They didn't have the same technique. But I don't understand it either, because the NBA is a total copycat league. Somebody's doing something well, everybody tries to copy. Remember when they got the Spud Webbs and the other guys, the Muggsy Bogues of the world?
The little
guys. They were trying to get the little guy a point guard. There's no way you're going to win a championship playing with a little guy as your starting point guard, I can tell you that. And they found that out after a while. But they always change, and they try all these other things to copy what's successful. And why nobody has willing to copy that, and they let their egos get in the way, who the hell cares how you do it? If you could stand there and throw it over your head with your eyes closed and make a higher percentage, then that's the way you should do it.
Well, your eyes weren't closed when you got to watch your three sons. I think it's remarkable to have three sons play in the NBA, John, Brent, and Drew.
It should have been five, guys. Should have been five, actually. All five of my boys should have been. My son Scooter should have been in the NBA. Bird and McHale both said, Rick, your son should have made our team. He was better than our number one draft pick, but they had 12 no-cut contracts. They had 12-man rosters back then, and they had 13 no-cut contracts. There was no room for him, so he played overseas until he was 40, had a terrific career over there, but he deserved to be in the league. And then my youngest son, Canyon, has not gotten a shot, and he deserves a chance, because I can assure you, not as a father speaking, I know basketball, and I'm a very honest person. If my son wasn't any good, I will tell you. My son to play better than a whole bunch of guys making millions of dollars. He doesn't have a glaring weakness. He's a 40% three-point shooter. He's an 85 to 90% underhanded free throw shooter. He knows the game inside out. He's so freaking smart. He's got his master's in nuclear engineering. He knows the game inside out, understands weak side defense and help. He's a heck of a player, and somebody could steal him for a minimum contract, and he's not getting a chance. It's pathetic. And it breaks my heart because he's such a great kid. Not worried about his future because he's so smart, but I hate to see talent wasted.
Oh, I don't blame you. Hey, Bob, a couple more questions from me before we let Rick go. You were good enough to suffer my question about coming up short in the 67 finals, but you guys did not come up short in 74-75, beating the Bullets and Wes Unsell and Elvin Hayes in the championship. You swept them in four. Hey, Rick, that was a kind of a magical season almost in a way. What are the great memories that stand out from that 74-75 NBA championship season for Golden State?
Well, it's the greatest upset in the history of major professional sports in the finals. I tell anybody, I defy them. Give me something that was more dramatic than that. Nothing.
Yeah.
They say, oh, Joe Namath, Super Bowl. No, bull. Joe Namath on the Jets, they were picked to be a really good team in the AFL. Yeah, it was an upset. They beat them, but it wasn't like us. We weren't even supposed to be a playoff team.
Right.
We were written off at the start of the season. Not only do we wind up getting, we get to the finals, and pull off, bigger upset. And then they said, this is the greatest mismatch in the history of NBA finals. It's going to be a sweep. Well, they got the sweep part right, but they got the wrong team. So it was an incredible accomplishment. It's the most overlooked accomplishment of professional sports in this country for a team that got no recognition. We didn't get invited to the White House. We didn't get a cover story on Sports Illustrated. They've never done any feature on television about us. And I'm really delighted that we're going to have a documentary coming out about our team and the accomplishment. And I'm so happy because this is a chance for my teammates to get the credit that they deserve, because we epitomize what the game of basketball is about. It's a team sport, and we played as a team, and we won as a team. And I wasn't the most important player on that basketball team. The most important player on our basketball team was Clifford Ray. He's the guy that brought everybody together. We had a two-headed monster in Clifford Ray and George Johnson. We had two rookies who were instrumental in our success. Jamal Wilkes, who was Keith Wilkes at the time, who got Rookie of the Year, and Phil Smith, who came along and played exceptionally well, and a bunch of other players like Derek Dickey and Charles Johnson and Butch Beard, who was our starting point guard. Charles Dudley. I mean, and we picked up Bill Bridges, and we had Jeff Mullins as two veteran guys who came off the bench. That was an incredible team. It was an incredible season. My greatest fondest memory. I've got rings from top 50. I got rings from Hall of Fame. Wonderful night to get those accomplishments, but you don't play for individual honors. You play for championships. My prized possession is my championship ring from 1975.
Well, I bet it is. Hey, do me a favor. Take me, please, into the locker room of a team like yours at the start of that season when you were counted out, people weren't talking about you. Did you know that there was skill there? Obviously, with players like Wilkes, you had good players. But what was it? What drove you? What got you all believing that, hell, we can win this damn thing? We can beat these teams.
Well, I think after we went to training camp and we saw the group of people that we had and the way everybody was approaching things, that we were going to be a better team than people thought we were going to be. To say that I thought we could win it all, that would have been ludicrous for me to think that at the start of the season. I knew that we were better than what people thought. I'm fairly certain that we could play well enough to be a playoff team. But then as things went on and we got later into the season and saw what we were doing, I said, hey, we could do okay. And then when Boston, you know, when Boston lost, actually Boston had a tough time against us. We matched up really well against Boston. And then it was going to be Washington. You know, they said, oh, well, they beat them during the regular season. Yeah. But I played two games that I probably shouldn't have played in. And I was hurt, and I still played. And they said, Reardon could guard me. I said, that's ridiculous. I mean, he's smaller than I am, and I'm quicker and faster than he is.
Yeah.
And that proved to be true. That, I mean, there's no way they were going to go ahead and Mike Reardon was going to shut me down. Because, first of all, nobody ever shuts down a great scorer. I was a great scorer. And you can't do that. When I hear these announcers on television, former players say, well, this guy's a lockdown defender. Trust me. There's no such thing as a lockdown defender against a scorer. You can lock down a shooter. You're never going to lock down a scorer. You just got to hope he's having a bad day and make him work a little bit harder. And if a guy still scores his 30 points and he has to take 3, 4, 5 more shots, he's done a good job.
Is Steph a pure scorer? How do you classify him? Who's the best pure scorer ever?
Will Chamberlain. Mm-hmm. 50 points a game. Yeah. I mean, God. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of great ones. Michael was a great scorer. The difference is that the thing about Steph is there's shooters and scorers. Steph is both.
Yeah.
Okay? He's both. Because he can score anyway. He can score from distance. He can score mid-range. He moves without the ball well. He can get to the basket and finish with either hand. He's a great free-throw shooter. Yeah, and same thing. You know, Kevin Durant, same way. Yeah, you can't shut down a player like that. For these guys to make a statement that somebody's a lockdown defender, I said, well, that's because you were not a great scorer and you were locked down sometime in your career.
Hey, final question from me, and it's a little bit of an inside question, but it has to do with our friend Johnny Holiday. Johnny was our second guest on Musings on Sports, Rick, and I know that when you had to sit out a season, that allowed you to play for Johnny's charity basketball team in the Bay Area. And I'm wondering, Rick, how did it feel for you to be passing the ball to Johnny Holiday, who, from what I understand, never missed a shot that he could take from any spot on the court? Is there all kinds of truth to that?
Yeah, never saw a shot that he didn't like. Yeah, that's the thing. So Johnny was actually one of my boys. He's the godfather to my oldest son, Scooter. And we got to be really close friends. And, you know, I just wanted to have a chance. It was a chance to go raise some money for the schools and for me to get out and play a little bit. So I played point guard, and Johnny was the shooting guard, and he shot, I can tell you that. And I fed him like I'd feed the pigeons in Central Park. But the thing is the pigeons probably ate more of the food than Johnny made shots. But he was great. He's a great guy, unbelievable, talented person. You know, disc jockey of the year one time. You know, he does acting and theater and all the other things, and he's had an incredible career as a broadcaster. And he's been a dear friend of mine for a long time. But that was quite interesting with he and the KYA Radio Wonders. Yes, that was pretty interesting stuff.
Mr. Bupka, I'll let you close it out with our great guest, Rick Barry, please.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm at a loss for words. I hate to close it out because it was so enjoyable. Rick Barry, one of the greatest, if not greatest, ever to play the game. Thanks for joining us on Musing on Sports. And hope to catch up with you at another time.
Let me finish up telling people here. Listen, everybody find a passion in life, okay? Everybody should have a passion in life. I don't care what your profession is. You got to have passions. You know, my passion was basketball. I still love the game dearly. Unfortunately, I can't play it, so I don't even try to play it. I mean, they say, you still play? I said, why the hell would I want to go play something I used to be really good at and be mediocre at best? And then hurt myself in the process. So I found long driving in golf. I won a number of world long driving championships in my age category. Then they got rid of that. And then now I'm into pickleball. And now I'm one of the best pickleball players at my age and skill level in the world. And that's great for me because I love competition. I've won U.S. Opens. I've won, you know, USA Pickleball National Championships. I've won world championships. And so that's what keeps me going. And I think you need to have that in life. And so you have to have stuff you look for. And then my other one is fly fishing. You know, big time. I love to fly fish.
Oh, my gosh. And, yeah.
Those are the things that keep me going. And I'm involved in a lot of businesses. And for your people who are listening, if you want, never try cannabinoids, you need to do it. You know, everybody hears CBD, but CBD is one of 130 or more cannabinoids. I'm with a company that's a cannabinoid company called Medicileaf, M-E-D-I-C-I-L-E-A-F, Medicileaf. And they've got some great products along with another one that we've merged with another company called Aloe MD Plus. You can go to medicinalleaf.com, put the code 24, and you'll get a great discount. You should try these products. You know, there's no drugs in them, no THC or anything of that nature. Incredible products that I use on a daily basis. And if you've got problems with your knees or your Achilles or things of that nature, your calves, go to GoSleeves.com. GoSleeves.com. Put RB24 code. You get a great discount there. I wear them all the time when I play pickleball. Fantastic stuff. Products that I highly recommend. I'm so busy now. I've got so many different businesses that I'm involved in, trying to do things to help people, stuff for the military, and trying to help our military people who I am a big supporter of. So God bless them for putting their lives on the line for us. Anyway, that's just a few of the things that I'm doing. God bless everybody. I hope everybody's enjoying their summer.
Thanks, Rick.
And Rick, I can definitely see you having a lot of success on the pickleball court with that large frame of yours, huh? It's a lot of fun, isn't it?
Well, it's a good reaction. I mean, I still have great hands, and I still can move pretty well at my advanced age, and it's so much fun. I love it. I just actually played this morning and get ready to play in a tournament on Thursday up in Denver, and then back to the Big Three, which I'm coaching in, which I have enjoyed. And I appreciate Ice Cube giving me a chance to coach in that league since it's been in existence. He's a great guy. Really love meeting him, and hopefully things will continue to progress and do well there. So I'm very fortunate, very blessed with health. So I hope everybody else is enjoying the same.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Hey, Bob, having someone on like Rick Barry with his vast knowledge of the NBA is always a treat. A great player. Has been an announcer for a long, long time. Barry, and opinionated. And that, to me, makes a great guest. And I hope all of our listeners learned a lot in listening to Rick.
Well, they certainly had to. I mean, Rick Barry tells it like it is, played the game like it is. Truly one of the great all-time basketball players. And as unfortunate it was for the passing of Bill Russell, good timing for the listeners of Musings on Sports because they got an opportunity to hear what Rick Barry had to say about the one, the only Bill Russell.
Well, that's exactly right. And we thank Rick Barry for his time and his terrific insights. Next week, a gentleman by the name of John Simpson, a name you might not necessarily recognize. John started the Simpson Cup, which is a 13-player Ryder Cup-style golf tournament between the United States and the UK, held annually. Later this month, to be played at Baltusrol Golf Club in Springfield, New Jersey. These are wounded warriors, veterans who've been hurt in the line of duty. And not only what John has done, Bob, through this tournament, but through his On Course Foundation, literally, Bob, has saved lives.
He really has. And the interview is inspirational. And I know our listeners are musing on sports are really are going to come away moved from the words of Mr. Simpson.
Yeah, agreed. So again, John Simpson from the Simpson Cup next week on Musings on Sports. We invite you to catch all of Musings on Sports either on the Musings on Sports Facebook page. We'd love for you to go to morningread.com where you can find great articles and can download and listen to the Musings on Sports podcast. Or just go wherever you enjoy your podcast. For my good friend, Bob Bupka, this is Mr. 34, Kelly Elbin, signing off Musings on Sports.